Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Boquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, education, and the environment. Well, this year is extra special for the Norwalk Seaport Association because it's celebrating the 150th birthday of the Sheffield Island Lighthouse. It's now listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and in our opening segment, you're going to join us on a trip to the island to learn how important this lighthouse was to coastal and ocean-going shipping during its years of service, and why the lighthouse and Sheffield Island itself continue to serve as a destination for visitors, an educational center for students, and a fantastic place to experience the environment of Norwalk Harbor and Long Island Sound. Then we're going to celebrate the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, opening later this week in Greater New Haven. For 22 years, the festival has delighted audiences with an outstanding mix of entertaining and inspiring programs that define the festival as the region's premier arts and culture destination, with more than 170 events, hey, and at least 85% of them are totally free. Then we're going to replay a March visit with the contact at United Way of Connecticut to talk about ALICE, that's Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed, to review some important points of a brand new national ALICE report, The Consequences of Insufficient Household Income, which explores the strategies deployed and subsequent consequences that result when households don't earn enough to make ends meet. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Boquette, right after this reminder. Families are invited to select and keep children's books that are now available at the Plainfield Family Resource Center and 29 other locations across the state, from Norwalk to Putnam, from Torrington to New London. The new book place, which is supplied by the nonprofit Read to Grow, was set up just last month, and a bookshelf at the FRC's hallway displays books being offered and will be restocked regularly by Read to Grow. The Plainfield FRC is on Norwich Road, and for more details on this book place and 29 others in Connecticut, just go to readtogrow.org. All right. Well, of all the places that I get to go for this radio show, I have to say I am at one of the most, if not the most, picturesque right now. And I'm with a guy that's going to be uniquely qualified to tell me all about it. Greg Gumrigian is with me here. It is the Sheffield Island Lighthouse here in the Norwalk Harbor, and an iconic symbol of Connecticut's maritime history, and a very special beginning of the season for Greg, the Norwalk Seaport Association, and the lighthouse, because it's 150 years old this year. So pretty exciting milestone out here on the island. On the way out here on the boat, we got to learn a little bit about the repopulation of the ospreys that are actually just a few feet away from one of them tending their nest here on the dock at Sheffield Island. An interesting environmental location, great place to visit, a lot of history here, and we'll get started talking about it. By first, Greg, just asking you, is this a lifelong pursuit of yours? How did you end up in all the jobs in all the world here on Sheffield Island?
Right place at the right time.
Your uncle owned it. Right?
I was a volunteer out here for a number of years, and over that period of time, we'd had several lightkeepers. And I felt as though with my passion for the island and the work I'd done out here with a great group of individuals, with the Seaport Association, the volunteers that come out here, that I'd like to step in and try the position out. Mm-hmm. And I really, growing up out in the Norwalk area and the Norwalk Islands, I really fell in love with Sheffield. And it's a unique opportunity for someone to be out here as the lightkeeper. And I'm honored to be the lightkeeper out here at Sheffield, especially with their 150th coming up.
And is this a second career for you, or did you always have aquaculture, seagoing work in your blood?
I grew up on the water here in Norwalk, but believe it or not, I'm a tour director in Washington, D.C.
And
a tour guide. So it kind of fell into my, you know, what I do as far as giving tours. But again, you know, it's a different situation out here. You're out on an island. And again, we're unique because we do have an island. We have a ferry boat, like you said, with a nice ride. You can come out and visit. The island itself, picturesque, a lot of history out here, going back to the even prior to this building going up. So it was a great opportunity to really to pursue, and I'm glad and I'm honored that the Norwalk Seaport Association chose me to come back this year as a lightkeeper.
Excellent. Well, take us back in time, because there were people living on this island before the lighthouse was even built.
That is correct. This Norwalk Islands were populated. They were founded by Adrian Block, Block Island fame. And geologically, they're basically an eye blink. They were formed probably about 10,000 years ago during the last ice age. But if you look at the building itself, there were a number of buildings here on the island prior to this one. The first lighthouse itself was about a 36-foot high tower just offshore. And I'm pointing west. And the lamp was not that bright, because Norwalk became a very popular seaport town for trade. And they needed to put something else larger up. So when they constructed this in 1868, it did the purpose of what that lighthouse could not accomplish. And this was decommissioned in the early 1900s, 1901, and they put up the two spark plug lighthouses that are now on the east and west entrance to Norwalk Harbor.
And we heard about another, I think on the way out on the boat, another lighthouse that was essentially taken out of commission for a newer, brighter lighthouse that was built.
When the tower came down, this one was commissioned, and then when this one went offline, they put the two spark plug, they call them, islands or lighthouses on either end of the harbor.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Well, tell us a little bit about the Block family that was living here, but when they decided to build the Sheffield Island Lighthouse?
No, the gentleman's name was Sheffield, Robert Sheffield. Captain Sheffield, and his daughter married a gentleman named Gershom Smith. And Gershom Smith was actually appointed the first lightkeeper here on Sheffield Island. When the tower was in operation, there's a keeper's cottage that's located just rear of the building. That was the original keeper's cottage for him back in 1827. So when they commissioned the lighthouse in 1868, they moved into the building itself. It's unique because the lighthouse is not just a beacon, but it's also a living quarters as well. And all the light keepers since then have lived in the building, in the lighthouse itself. When it became a historic structure, the Norwalk Seaport Association purchased it from the Stabell family. We moved operations back into the keeper's cottage, and keeping this in the historic fashion, now utilize it just for touring.
And did I understand correctly, there's actually three entities that own and operate pieces of the Sheffield Island?
In itself, yes. All the Norwalk Islands are Fish and Wildlife, Connecticut, Stuart B. McKinney system. Yeah. We operate about 2 acres here that you're looking at. This is our area or our property that we work off of. The Stabell family owns the, the western end of the island over here, but the Connecticut Fish and Wildlife manages from the nature trail all the way back where the sign is.
So one of the exciting things for people who may come out here on their own watercraft to spend the day or take the boat right out from just beside the Norwalk Maritime Center is for the hiking and the bird watching. And as we mentioned in the introduction, we have the reestablishment of the osprey population, which, if I understood correctly from Dan on the way out here, was down to single digits.
Yes, it was at one point, and we're very happy about that because the osprey are important to the environment, important to the area as well. We do have, the Seaport does offer a bird watching cruise. Larry Flynn, the bird conservator, is very knowledgeable. He will take people out. The boat will probably cruise the islands for about 2 hours, and he'll point out species of birds all the way down close to Westport and coming up to this island as well. So that could be found on our website.
Oh. Does Sheffield Island and the Norwalk Islands in general serve as a stopping point in migration patterns?
With some species, yes. You will see a lot of birds that winter over here, but a large population of the birds do fly south, and from what I understand, some thousands of miles.
Oh, okay. So also, as part of the 150th anniversary celebration, I understand in July there's going to be a kind of a main event, but there will be this kind of heightened attention to the milestone anniversary until basically it's
too cold or too uncomfortable to come out here on a boat.
We're celebrating all seasons, so we're very happy and proud that the building is turning 150. She's a grand old lady. She's the jewel of Long Island Sound, and we will be celebrating the entire season through different events. Again, with the on July 28th, we'll have the large, we'll call it a black tie event out here as well. But we will be celebrating with family days. We will be promoting that as the basis for this year. This season is the 150th birthday of the Sheffield Island Lighthouse.
Mm-hmm. And what else is there to do on the accessible parts of the island? Are hiking trails and things like that?
There's a nature trail that goes into the woods with an overlook. The overlook has several boards on it that will explain fauna, animal life, nature. As you're walking through, you can take a look around. There's different plant life as well. When Fish and Wildlife is out here, they do offer explanations and programs, and they teach you about a lot of the plant life, the animal life that inhabit the island. Yeah. But the nature walk is, people will do it as they come out to the island. It's just another venue for, you know, besides coming out and relaxing and picnicking, which you can do, you can take a quick walk. We could also walk the shoreline. You can see the number of sea creatures, the crabs, horseshoe crabs, you know, all kinds of different animals that inhabit the shoreline as well. And now we are at low tide, so they're more accessible.
Mm. And I'm told on a clear day you can see Manhattan.
Oh, yeah. About 40 nautical miles west in this direction, you can, you can see the skyline of Manhattan, which is quite, at night is a beautiful, beautiful sight. We're located about a mile off the shore here. And so coming off of Norwalk, and then you have Long Island about 6 to 8 miles in that direction, which again is unique. So we are the westernmost island. That's why the lighthouse was put here on this spot.
Super. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're about halfway through our chat here and hanging out on Sheffield Island in the Norwalk Harbor with Greg Grigian. He is the lighthouse keeper and essentially the designated guide and supervisor of all that is going on here on the island under the umbrella of the Norwalk Seaport Association, who are good friends to many of our stations as a result of the partnership that we've had with them for so long with the Norwalk Oyster Festival, which is something I really try not to let get by when we're talking about the Connecticut coastline, because it seemed like all 20-some-odd people with me on the boat, except me, when they said Norwalk was one of the world's largest suppliers of oysters, people were like, "Worlds? The worlds?" It was almost unbelievable that a place so close and familiar, and where you don't think of actually just going along the shoreline and getting your own oysters for dinner or whatever, but it has sustained the economy of this this community and this region for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. That is correct. We're very lucky to have that here. Oysters are an integral part, obviously, of Norwalk's history as well. But another main reason for the lighthouse is here for ship navigation.
And also just the funny story about Tavern Island.
Oh, Tavern.
Which, between the Prohibition era speakeasy and the headless ex-wives statuary, that in and of itself must be an interesting visit if you could afford to buy it.
Yeah, only $10.5 million.
Hey, yeah. they've rolled that price down, I understand.
I heard,
right?
12-something.
Yep. So in the last few minutes that we have with you, Greg,
sure.
Walk me through the process here to the extent that you can of what it took to build the grand old lady of Connecticut Seacoast here at the Sheffield Island Lighthouse.
Well, it's an interesting story. If you look at Long Island Sound, you wouldn't think that many, many years ago it could freeze over. And it did. And that's how the blocks were brought out. They were mined up north of Route 7. And the blocks were brought down individually on sleighs pulled by oxen right over the ice.
Wow.
And then as the ice thawed, obviously they came out by barge as well. But she was constructed. She's one of six lighthouses in the area, sister lighthouses, Great Captain in Greenwich. And then you've got the one over in Port Jeff. You have Plum Island. So the lighthouses are similar in structure, shape, and design as far as this one is as well.
And you're built in 1868. Everything we're seeing now from the dock side of the lighthouse is virtually original to the structure?
Yes. You're looking at, the structure itself is original. We had a major restoration process several years ago, including the repointing of the stone, that was done right down to historical records. They even matched the concrete and the filler to properties of what it was when the lighthouse was constructed back in 1868. It included the new the roofing, the repointing of the stone.
You should tell everybody else to turn that off.
Right?
Okay, we're going to mark that at 13 minutes.
The structure itself that you're looking at is all original.
So one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about was something you said that kind of took me by surprise getting off the boat. You said the both the native and non-native animals that live on the island. Mm-hmm. So does that mean at some point somebody dropped off some some creatures or they swam across or fell off boats? But tell me about the mix of the native versus non-native fauna here on the island.
Well, your native would be along the shoreline, the birds that inhabit the islands. Your non-native would be, native now would be the deer and the raccoon populations. And they're very adapted swimming. They're very, very good swimmers. You could see deer actually swimming across the harbor area here to get to the island at some points. But, there's a lot of different variety and species of animals out on the island. We have our, the bird life. We have reptiles and snakes and obviously the fish life that's surrounding the island as well, the crabs along the shore. It's a beautiful place just to sit and study, especially the plant life. There's a huge variety of plants here on the island. So if you're a naturalist or you're a bird watcher, it's a great place to be. I could just sit and watch the osprey for days. Especially when the chicks hatch. But, we have done our best to maintain the look of the island to make sure that we're not really putting anything as far as plants on the island that are not native or that would not take to the island as well. And the seaport staff and the volunteers are very cautious in trying to maintain the aura of the island the way it looked back in the 1860s because, it is a historical structure. We want to make sure that generations can appreciate it. Moving forward, that's why we're putting our efforts into it now to try to maintain it and keep it the way it is.
And I'm glad you brought us back around to the Seaport Association because it's appropriate that we close out talking about that. While the Sheffield Island Lighthouse and its 150th anniversary celebration is a keystone to the 2018 tourism season, this is by far not the only thing that the Norwalk Seaport Association is involved with. Of course, the Oyster Festival is probably the big destination, but there are a number of other things that the association does that have nothing to do really with the keeping of the boat and the dock by the Maritime Center.
No, we're involved in educational programs that we partner with Fish and Wildlife. And again, our bird program with Larry Flynn, who comes out. We do run a number of other wonderful opportunities. You have a number of wonderful opportunities for people to come out just on cruises alone on the boat. It just doesn't, you don't have to land on the lighthouse, but the boat is offered as far as corporate functions or whatever you wish to use. And I'll tell you what, coming out at night, the sunsets are just gorgeous. I mean, if you can take advantage of something like that. We are lucky as a staff and volunteers to sometimes wake up in the morning to a nice sunrise and go to sleep. There's some of the natives now. We get to wake up to a sunrise and go to sleep to a beautiful sunset over the shoreline here. Yeah. And it's unique because it is an island and we enjoy it. And the seaport, again, through island, through the Oyster Festival, through the education programs, we try to bring and teach people out a little bit more about Sheffield, about the history of the islands. We just hope that everybody comes out and has a pleasant experience out
and
here.
And we came out in the third trip of Saturday of Memorial Day weekend. Is that going to sort of be the weekend routine now through the season, 2 to 3 or more trips per day on the weekend for people to come out? And that kind of keeps the group small enough so you can kind of keep it under control, make sure the island's not overrun with people?
Yes, we will run constantly. We'll run three boats on Saturdays and Sundays, mm-hmm. and on holiday weekends, check the schedule online. You can also reserve a seat online as well. During the week, the schedule will vary a little bit as far as how many boats, but usually on the weekends, yes, we will be running three boats. We do have the events coming up with the Haunted Lighthouse that'll be coming up as well. We'll probably put a fourth boat on for that. So just keep in tune with the website. But that is another event that we will have out here on the island. That's a lot of fun for the kids.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah. The Norwalk Seaport Association was founded in 1978 by a group of local citizens who had the vision to revitalize South Norwalk and preserve Norwalk's maritime heritage. A good part of that and part of the reason why we have such an informed and gracious host today is because our guest, Greg Goomrigian, has been involved with this group, starting as a volunteer. He's now the lighthouse keeper and kind of the overseer of the island, the Sheffield Island. With the iconic Sheffield Island Lighthouse is a symbol of Connecticut's maritime history, and the lightkeeper's cottage in the lighthouse will welcome you here to Sheffield Island. If you're so inclined, you can take weekend trips out here, and it is the 150th birthday celebration, built in 1868, retired in 1902, and been serving as a place to relax and recreate and learn about the flora and fauna of the Norwalk Harbor and the Long Island Sound area. A lot of opportunities here for kids, families, anyone who wants to come out. Greg and his able staff and all the folks at the Norwalk Seaport Association will be glad to have you check them out online. And Greg, thank you so much for your knowledge and information.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Well, we come around to this event every year about this time, and we're not always talking to the same person about it, and I'm so glad to make the acquaintance of a brand new friend associated with the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. For 22 years, the festival's delighted audiences with an incredible mix of entertaining and inspiring programs, internationally acclaimed dance, an eclectic array of world-class musicians, circus, groundbreaking theater, engaging speakers define this festival as the region's premier arts and culture destination. More than 8 out of 10 of the events over the course of the festival, June 9th through 23rd, are absolutely free. Most are family-friendly, and we're going to talk about it all with Chad Herzog. He's the co-executive director of this year's International Festival of Arts and Ideas. Artidea.org is the website. You can go there for everything from tickets to information and parking, but we'll talk more about that as well as we go. In the meantime, Chad, thanks for joining us on the program this morning.
It's so great to be here. Thank you.
So a pretty incredible lineup as always. And really, I mean, the thing that we don't talk enough about is what an incredible economic driver this is. This is not a festival that's just great for the festival participants and the acts and the artists and the audience, but there is a collateral benefit virtually to the entire state, and I dare say perhaps even the tri-state region, because you've got people traveling in that are getting gas and going to restaurants and maybe poking around in between activities and going shopping, and it really is a little 2 week long economic engine that really pumps up the greater New Haven area and the entire state of Connecticut.
That it is. We welcome nearly 100,000 people to the festival every year, and we're told by businesses in and around town that June has never been better for them when it's festival time. So I think one thing that the festival does quite well is drive the economy of the state and welcomes visitors that, you know, come from all over. 26 states last year joined us at the festival.
And then kind of moving down the line from there, it also exposes a lot of people to artists that might not otherwise get their attention, especially when they're in situations where there's no admission charge to see and in many cases interact with these artists, whether you're coming as an adult or a child of any age. This is not just you stand on one side of the line, the artists stand on the other, do their thing, you watch, and then move on to the next. There is so much, getting up on stilts and juggling and making puzzles and drawing and singing and playing instruments. It's just a fantastic family activity as well.
You said it very well. It's 80% of the programming is free. It's there's really something at this festival, like all of our festivals, that is something for everyone. And hopefully something that you didn't know was for you as you peruse and take a look at the festival programming. Maybe you happen upon something that you weren't quite sure of, but you took a chance with us, and I think you're going to enjoy it.
Yeah, the artists will sell a piece of art, or somebody will go out and buy a DVD or an album featuring that artist, or better yet, they'll see something like a performance that's happening early in the festival that may be reoccurring or happening throughout, and they're going to go tell 10 friends to go and see this. You can't miss it. It's a lot of word of mouth buzz around a lot of the acts that happen, especially those that sustain throughout the event or have multiple stations over the course of the couple of weeks.
All right, and we know that our number one ticket selling force is the word of mouth, so we really appreciate it when people talk about the festival and share what they're excited about.
Excellent. So let's talk about you for just a couple of minutes, Chad.
Sure.
Tell me how you moved into this interesting dichotomy, this co-executive director position.
Sure. So I moved to New Haven 3 years ago when I joined the festival. So this is my third festival that I've been partially responsible for. And last year when Tom Griggs, who is our director of development, and Liz Fisher, our managing director, the three of us served as interim directors of the festival last year as the board was searching for a new director. And due to other circumstances, the board chose not to fill that position and instead moved the three of us into the position as one.
Mm-hmm. And does that work well both among the three of you and have a benefit to the festival because it not only spreads out the responsibilities but also brings particular passions of each individual to particular aspects of the festival?
Yeah, it's been working really great. Tom is born and raised in Connecticut, knows this area really better than anyone else I've met. Liz has been with the festival for 20 years now, so her knowledge of the festival and her experience professionally before she got to the festival and since she's been here is vital. And then me as still the newcomer, getting to know the city in which I live and the area in which I live has been good to have both of them around. And the way we work together is Tom is our chief fundraiser. Liz manages all of our business relationships, among other things. And then I provide the artistic direction or the programming for the festival. So that's how we do it, and it's been working very well.
Is this something that you have a background in, doing kind of artistic events, or do you have event management background, or are you an artist yourself?
All of the above.
Okay.
When I joined the festival 3 years ago, I came in as the director of programming. So it was, again, providing the artistic direction of the festival going forward. And then before I arrived to the festival, I was the director of arts and culture for a small university and have spent almost 20 years of my life working in this field.
Fantastic. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Chad Herzog. He's co-executive director of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, coming into the greater New Haven area June 9th through the 23rd. ArtIdea.org is the website to go if you're interested in attending a ticketed event, although about 85% of all of the events festival-wide are absolutely free, most family-friendly. We're going to talk about a few of them coming up, but really an exciting thing that I'm hearing about for the first time that's actually happening a couple of days before the official opening of the festival, and this is an ideas event that involves young people and civics. Is that right, Chad?
And citizenship. So the festival has for now 7 years had high school fellows, a high school fellowship program. Our fellows join us in January every year. It's an application process. This year we have 13 high school fellows from 10 different New Haven public schools, and they join us in January, take class with us once a week for the semester. While they're taking class with us, they're actually taking the class at Gateway Community College, so they're earning 4 college credits for the semester that culminates at the end of our festival. So they take class with us in the classroom setting, and then once we get to festival time, they are participating in all aspects of the festival. And one of the first things that they do is this ideas program that we're calling Exploring Citizenship, Arts as a Gate Opener, a town hall. That will be on Thursday, June 7th, and happens in the New Haven Free Public Library downtown branch, the Ives branch of the New Haven Free Public Library. And you'll get to see what our true leaders of the city are doing, and those are these high school students.
Wow, that's exciting. Probably it will end up being more exciting for the audience than even the young people involved, because they've sort of been immersed in this process for several months now. But it's really great to see, kind of as you said, the next generation of our leaders here in New Haven and Connecticut and wherever they may go after this, taking this experience with them and perhaps doing things like you're doing right now.
So, yeah, you never know. And this year they'll be really jumping into the themes of Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen and American Lyric. Last year they spent time talking about gun violence. Last year was standing room only. I have no doubt that it's going to be the same way this year. And you want to be inspired. You want to come to this.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break, Chad, and we're going to come back and focus on a few key aspects of the festival. And if you'll stick with us, I know folks want to hear about some of your recommended high points of the festival and maybe a couple of hidden gems as well. Stick with us, folks. We'll be back in just a moment. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Public Affairs Director John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. As part of a national movement to educate and empower women to become an active participant in the political process, Fairfield University is hosting Ready to Run Connecticut, the university's second annual nonpartisan women's leadership and campaign training program. It's happening on Saturday, June 16th, all day at the campus in Fairfield. From campaign strategists and media specialists to a diverse roster of elected officials spanning parties and legislative positions, each of the program's 6 workshops employ the expertise, advice, and proven track record of state, local, and regional experts to advance registrants' political aspirations. For more additional program details or to register, visit fairfield.edu/R2RCT. All right, we're back, and it's almost time for the International Festival of Arts and Ideas here in Greater New Haven. It runs June 9th through the 23rd, but as you heard right before we came on break, there's actually activity starting as early as Thursday, June 7th, with this ideas event happening at the library in New Haven. So let's switch gears with Chad Herzog. He's co-executive director and our guest this morning. Chad, there's a handful full of things that we want to talk about for just a minute or two each to give folks an idea of just a fraction of the activities that are happening at this year's event. Over 170 in all happening, but can't talk about all of them. But let's talk small first. Radicals in Miniature, what's that about?
Radicals in Miniature is a beautiful piece of theater that is made by Ayne Gordon and Josh Killen, and they tell the stories of those who have been forgotten. Really taking place, these stories taking place from 1968 to 1993. As we know, so much of this country changed in 1968, 50 years ago. Mm. There's 25 years after that. We had the sexual revolutions and the AIDS crisis in this country. Anne and Josh tell the stories of those people who you've probably never heard the names of, but who were extremely important and making this country tick, and especially New York tick, over that time period.
Fantastic. Well, folks may not have heard of Radicals in Miniature. It's certainly highly recommended. But if they want to do something a little bit more familiar, there's The Merchant of Venice.
And The Merchant of Venice. And what's cool about both of these pieces is when the New York Times recently named us one of the top 15 festivals of the summer, they feature both Radicals in Miniature and Merchant of Venice for naming us that. So kind of cool that you've too put these back to back. Merchant of Venice, we all know the story of Merchant of Venice. What you don't know about this Merchant of Venice is that, one, it takes place in the Yale Law School courtyard, so we'll be spending beautiful June evenings outside watching this performance. And what a better place to see a story like The Merchant of Venice than the law school courtyard. The other thing that makes this merchant quite different is Karin Coonrod, the artistic director of Merchant of Venice and the director of the piece, has decided to have five different actors play Shylock. And so Shylock in this merchant is played by male, female, person of color, Jewish person, a Muslim, and a Christian. So five different people play Shylock, and her reasoning behind this is, it's quite smart, is she believes that there's a little bit of Shylock in all of us. And so she has represented Shylock quite well.
And this isn't five people over the course of five performances. This is five Shylocks in each performance.
Right. So she essentially breaks the play down into five parts. And each part, Shylock is played by a different actor, is the audience quickly learns who's playing Shylock just by a sash that they're wearing, and they come together at the end.
That's so cool. Well, the other thing we've been hearing about, like probably aside from the announcement of the festival and welcoming you as one of the co-executives, we've been hearing for months about Pepperland. What's that? That is something that was sort of like a fixture of the festival before a lot of other things gelled, right?
You know, we work on these festivals a couple years out, and so two years ago when we were working on this festival, or nearly 3 years ago, we too were counting down to May of 2017, which marked the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album. And the Mark Morris Dance Group was asked by the city of Liverpool and the Beatles to create a commemorative dance for the 50th anniversary of the Beatles Sgt. Pepper album. And so last May, it premiered in Liverpool. This piece is called Pepperland. It's Mark's take on the Sgt. Pepper album. He worked alongside his music director, Ethan Iverson, to create mostly new music and all new dance to really celebrate an album that changed the world.
Fantastic. The other thing that people love to do, you mentioned The Merchant of Venice is taking place outside in the courtyard at the law school, but you know, people love the mix of the outdoor events, and certainly these free concerts on the green are very, very popular. In the last few minutes that we have with you, let's do a quick rundown on what people can see for free on the green as part of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas this year.
Sure, and we have so much to offer on the green. As you mentioned earlier, you know, 80% of the programming is free, and it starts on June 9th when we celebrate New Haven on the green on June 9th, where we bring our three neighborhood festivals together, and they bring the best of their festivals to the green on June 9th. And then we have a concert with the Langley Project, Elon Troutman, and Ron Lawrence that evening. Ron Lawrence is a New Haven jazz fixture. The Langley family has been making music in this city for years. And then Elon Troutman is no stranger to New Haven either. And I think we put all of them on the green together, and it's just sure to be a great night.
Excellent.
So that's on June 9th. On June 10th, we welcome an all-female mariachi group called Flores Soloche, and Las Capeteras, a band from Southern California. They'll be on the green. Their music's electrifying. Just you'll want to be dancing to it. You'll want to be singing to it. Mm. And anytime you see a mariachi group like Flores Soloche and listen to the lyrics of Las Capeteras, I trust you'll be moved.
Excellent.
We also have Houdini coming to the green. I think old school hip hop R&B mm-hmm. artist Houdini. They'll be here and joining us on the Wednesday of the festival. We have Ruth B, who is a Billboard top 10 recording artist. She probably is best known for her song that she wrote while on the social media app Vine, and it's called Lost Boys. She'll be on the green June 16th. And then we welcome Amir El Safar and his band, River of Sound Orchestra, along with the New Haven Symphony Orchestra, on Father's Day, June 17th. And it's going to be a really great afternoon of music. Amir has written an entire new piece of music for his band in the New Haven Symphony Orchestra.
Great. If we're talking to families out there who may be coming to the festival with an adult or two and maybe some children, high school, middle school age or younger, if there was one date or activity that you might want to steer those folks to that they can target as maybe one or one of more visits to the International Festival this year, what would that be, Chad?
I'm going to give you two, actually. The first would be June 9th. New Haven Day on the Green. The Green is just going to be hopping with all kinds of events from
starting
at 11 a.m. with a drill exhibition all the way through the evening. Box City's going on. It's just going to be a great time.
Great.
The other thing, though, if you have kids or if you like kids or if you like to dream and you like to get out and really let your mind escape for a little bit, we have a piece called A Billion Nights on Earth, and we have four performances of that, June 14th and 15th, both at 7 p.m., and then on the afternoon, two performances on the afternoon of June 16th, Saturday. This is a piece about a child and her father, and the young girl is a dreamer. She just, when the dad asked her to do her homework, she would rather be building spaceships. When the dad asked her to go to bed, she sneaks out on the roof and looks up at the stars. Mm. He really can't get her to focus with him at all. And until he finally gives in and dreams along, and they escape into this dream world through a portal in the refrigerator. And larger than life size puppets come at us. It's wow. It's an incredible piece of theater that, again, is something that would be good for 3 years and up.
Fantastic. Well, Chad Herzog is co-executive director of this year's International Festival of Arts and Ideas. It's happening with this great ideas event on June 7th, but the big opening where you can take the whole family and all your friends for the whole day is on June 9th, and then there's stuff happening every day through June 23rd. You can get the full schedule, purchase tickets to the few events that are ticketed. 85% of the events in the festival are free. There's more than 170 of them happening, and you get all of the information you need at artidea.org. Chad, thank you so much. Get some rest, charge up. It's going to be a busy, crazy, incredible, and successful 22nd plus year of the Festival of Arts and Ideas here in New Haven, and we thank you so much for taking time this morning to talk about it. All right. Well, as you heard in the introduction, we're going to talk about Alice with Annie. Annie is on the line with us. Annie Scully is a community outreach coordinator and analyst for United Way of Connecticut. And as you may have recalled, we've already done a couple of segments on Alice, which is an acronym for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. And I guess we're about 6 months away from a revised or updated version of that report, right?
Correct, John, and thanks for that great introduction. You're totally right that this is a United Way initiative, and actually in 2014 we put out our first report, mm-hmm. but our most recent report was released in October of 2016.
So it's going to be kind of like an every other year thing?
Exactly, yeah. We're sort of on an every 2 year schedule, and that has a lot to do with the great team of researchers that we work with through the National ALICE Project that are located in northern New Jersey. We're one of 16 states now that is part of this ALICE initiative, so
excellent.
They do a lot of number crunching, and we work closely with them to get some great data out every 2 years.
Well, for somebody who's an analyst, that's your cup of tea, I guess.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So the disturbing thing that I'm seeing right at the top here is that we could say virtually 4 out of every 10 people is in line at the drive-up, sitting beside us at church, at the soccer fields, in our own house party. 4 out of 10 are income constrained. 4 out of 10 people in Connecticut right now are ALICE.
You're absolutely right. And so what ALICE really does is it kind of paints a more accurate picture of people that struggle in Connecticut. So while only 11%, and I shouldn't say only, but why 11% of people are living below the federal income level, so they're literally in poverty in Connecticut, there's an additional 27% of households that struggle. And they struggle to meet their most basic needs. So we're not talking about, going on vacation or buying a new television. We're talking about affording, food for their children, about sending their kids to quality child care facilities or accredited centers, and just paying their monthly bills. So like you said, there's a large percentage of people in Connecticut that are having a hard time daily to just afford the bare bones budget.
And we're finding this across 169 towns, cities, and boroughs here in Connecticut.
Absolutely. ALICE lives in every town and city in Connecticut, and we even our more wealthy areas, we know that there's financial insecurity there, that there's people that really do need help.
So one of the things that has come out of this ALICE movement to date is a roadmap that United Way and the specialists who are working on this project have devised, right?
I'm assuming you're talking about this household survival budget.
Yes. A roadmap to at least navigate through, if not out of ALICE.
For sure.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So yeah, so it's this household survival budget is really a tool that is used to assess financial hardship for ALICE. And what we've seen between 2014 and 16, and anticipate seeing between 2016 and 2018, is that it continues to be more difficult to afford just the basics in Connecticut, and that's true across the country. And despite this increase in the cost of living, wages aren't quite keeping up with that, which is what continues to strain a lot of hardworking families. One important thing to point out about ALICE is that, employed is a defining characteristic. So despite working hard, there's a significant number of families and individuals that are struggling just to meet their basic needs. So this household survival budget in Connecticut consists of housing, child care, food, transportation, health care, taxes, and then like a small pot of money for any kind of miscellaneous needs that might arise. But one thing that's definitely missing is savings. So we know that ALICE households are super vulnerable to any kind of financial shock. So a flat tire, a new set of brakes for their car, temporary unemployment can really derail these ALICE families around this tight budget.
And certainly, you got to think about during a bad flu season like we're still experiencing here in Connecticut. A lot of folks, especially those with young kids and all the issues we've been seeing with young kids and the flu, they panic and maybe they have to go to a walk-in center, which is typically a high expense item that was unanticipated.
Absolutely. That's a great example. And not only is it, a big out-of-pocket expense, but that could mean, missing multiple days of work or keeping your kids, home from daycare for multiple days or home from school for multiple days. And that's a big hit on families that are really, living on a bare-bones budget and don't have a lot of money to spend outside of their basic needs.
So part of what has prompted us to give you a call, Annie, is the email that I got now about a week and a half ago or so about a new report that's kind of hit the streets about ALICE, which kind of both expands and deepens the look into the data that's been gathered so far. Tell us about this interim assertion into the program as we now are kind of looking down the road another 6 or 7 months to the 2018 ALICE update.
Absolutely. So you're totally correct. A few months ago, a new national report hit the pavement, and it's ALICE, the Consequences of Insufficient Income, Household Income. And it takes sort of using the ALICE data from 15 states that are currently involved in the ALICE initiative. It looks at really what it means, not only for those that are they're struggling financially, but for the communities they live in when people are on this tight budget and that they're facing daily obstacles and the strategies they use to kind of navigate this limited budget. And it takes a look at, you know, what do ALICE households do when they can't afford basic housing? And what does an ALICE household do when they can't afford childcare or when they can't afford to put enough nutritious food on their table? What do ALICE households do when they can't afford transportation? And then healthcare, what do ALICE families do when they're uninsured or underinsured and have to provide for their families and their children? So it's a new kind of way to look at our ALICE data. And one great thing about, I think, this ALICE project is it's more than just a data-driven exercise. It really invites a conversation, and it takes steps to sort of help ALICE find short and long-term solutions for their problems. So by sort of putting it in a perspective that people can understand and say, all right, day-to-day, what are these obstacles and how can we help ALICE to overcome these obstacles? And what are the consequences for those families when they're unable to do so? So this new report is fantastic.
So it sounds like above and beyond the household survival budget that's been out there for a while, this new report, which, by the way, you can download at alice.ctunitedway.org, gives kind of case studies from the front lines, if you will, that people can also use to develop either ideas or to kind of affirm and gain confidence in the moves that they're already making to try to conserve as much as possible and begin to move themselves, if not out of the ALICE situation, at least toward a place where they might be able to enjoy a little bit of discretionary income and or savings.
That's absolutely correct, and it also really reinforces this concept and this idea that we depend on ALICE, and when ALICE struggles, we all struggle. ALICE cares for our children, our aging parents, fixes our cars, and works in our local grocery stores, retail stores, and restaurants. So without ALICE in our communities, we're really struggling. So supporting ALICE and helping ALICE to achieve financial security is in everyone's best interest.
And without Connecticut United Ways here in our state, we wouldn't know about ALICE or have these great tools that are formulating or have been formulated to begin to address the issues that 4 out of 10 Connecticut households and individuals are facing. Tell us a little bit more about what Connecticut United Ways are doing, both with the data and information and experience they've now gained in the ALICE project since 2014, but also perhaps give us a look at how Connecticut United Ways may already be moving forward with the information inherent in this latest report.
Absolutely. So we're fortunate to work with our government and community partners to really promote the implementation of policies that can help ALICE families achieve financial security. And we advocate for health, education, and financial security for all of Connecticut residents with a focus on good jobs, fair wages, access to good schools, affordable housing, and quality child care that families can afford. We also invest. A lot of our partners across the state and individuals donate to United Ways, which we're so grateful for, and via those donations, we're able to invest in child care, early learning, basic needs, diverse housing options, job training, asset development, and financial education to really help put ALICE families on a path towards financial security. So we're currently, the legislative session is currently in session, and so if you, as you alluded to earlier, our alice.ctunitedway.org, you can download our 2018 policy agenda, which provide a little bit more detail about the different policies and initiatives that Connecticut United Ways support.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about not getting political, but from a strictly kind of clinical standpoint, in terms of the fact that we're in session right now in Hartford, are either Connecticut United Way leaders or individuals who work in agency partners throughout Connecticut already appearing or are planning to appear in front of the legislature to kind of use the ALICE acronym to help legislators become more familiar with the issue, as well as perhaps suggesting some ways that they can play a role in partnering with United Way at the state level to address some of these issues?
We absolutely hope so, and we're fortunate to work with great community partners, and we hope that this data can really paint a more accurate picture of the people in our communities across the state that do need help and that fall into this ALICE category where they might not be eligible for certain benefits because their income is too high, but then they're sort of in a catch-22 because they're not able to afford their basic needs. So, you know, what can we do to promote ALICE families to make sure that they are successful?
Yeah, like you said, so, the 27% who are not living below the poverty line, so they literally have it stamped on paper that they have eligibility for a number of assistance and support programs, but the others that, as you pointed out, or that we talked about, are a emergency room or walk-in clinic visit or a brake job or a fender bender car accident or something away from having to make a decision between going to that walk-in clinic or fixing the brakes or maybe waiting a couple weeks before they could pay their rent or their mortgage or they have to forego some groceries. So all critically important information. And folks, if you do want to tune in and check out all of the information available on the ALICE initiative, once again, you can go to alice.ctunitedway.org. I want to thank our guest this morning, Annie Scully. She's a community outreach coordinator and analyst for United Ways of Connecticut. ALICE is Asset Limited Income Constrained and Employed. If you are one of those 4 in 10 people, we hope you'll visit Connecticut's United Way website and take advantage of all of the resources that they are offering under the ALICE initiative and beyond to help support you here in Connecticut. So, Annie, thanks so much for being on the program, and we'll talk to you in the fall when the new 2018 ALICE update comes out. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.